was a very dark atmosphere for all of us, with war, with terror, bombings, lots of repression coming against us. Also around the universities, it was not that easy to talk about peace. Imagine you were reading a newspaper and you saw your name in a decree that says you were banned from the public services for all of your life. Actually, the rise of far right is threatening all over Europe. This is why we founded the Academics for Peace in Germany as well. Not only defend the academic freedom for Turkey, for all of us, actually.
Fragile Freedom. Researchers in Exile. Academic freedom is often taken for granted, but it's fragile, especially in authoritarian countries. Scientists are being silenced, threatened, and persecuted. In this live podcast series, researchers in exile share their stories with us. Academic freedom in Turkey is very limited and tightly controlled by President Erdogan's government. Since the renewed conflict with Kurdish groups in 2015 and the failed coup attempt in 2016, many university staff have been dismissed and the state actions have created a climate of fear in universities. Many academics now self-censor or have left the country.
My name is Frank Albrecht. I'm head of the Division Philip Schwartz Initiative and Academic Freedom at the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation. And I have the pleasure and honor to talk to ALEM today. In 2015, the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation and the Federal Foreign Office launched the Philip Schwartz Initiative, which is a program that supports researchers who have raised their voice, who are critical thinkers, and were forced into exile from their countries of origin. Another major group of Philip Schwartz fellows comes from countries where armed conflict forced them into exile. Now, the name Philip Schwartz Initiative, I have to say it's almost a historical irony, a tragic historical irony, because Philip Schwartz was a researcher, a pathologist from Germany who was forced into exile by the Nazis in 1933. He fled to Switzerland, but then moved on to Turkey, and he found not only refuge, but also an academic position and an academic purpose in Turkey. This is the person we chose to give his name to our initiative, and he's the model that we try to emulate. And now one of the largest groups of Philip Schwartz fellows under this program is actually researchers from Turkey. One of those researchers is here with us tonight, Dr. Elem Çamurlu. Thank you very much, Elem, for speaking with us today. And I'm really grateful that you're willing to open up about your professional perspective, but also your personal experiences. So maybe would you mind just briefly introducing yourself and your field of research?
Thank you so much, Frank. I'm also very happy to be here with you here today. I'm Elem Çamurlu, a visiting scholar, a guest researcher from Turkey. I'm calling myself also a guest, but it's a very long guestship, I guess, because almost 8 years has been passed now and I'm still in Bayreuth University. I studied communication studies in Turkey and worked as an assistant professor at Mersin University before I came to Bayreuth University. We will talk about the events that bring me here, the horrible things I will address. But let me only tell you my focus as a researcher. I'm a communication and media scholar, underlining this in Germany because it's a bit difficult here to explain only communication scholarship. In Turkey, we have communication faculties, but here media and communication are separated. My main area was journalism studies in Turkey. Here I'm at the media studies, but also combining media studies with communication studies a bit and also political theory. My specific focus was in Turkey public sphere theories and the coupling of neoliberalism with Islam and its effect on public sphere and public spaces, obviously. But also in regards to the questions of journalism a bit. I will also address them with your questions.
And just to understand your profile a bit more, what were your was your educational like? So what were the educational stages and what was your assistant professorship specifically before 2016?
I studied my bachelor's studies. I studied at Istanbul University in public relations at the communication faculty. Then master's I did at Istanbul University again, and after the master's MA degree, I started with my PhD work again at Istanbul University and journalism studies. I dealt with the questions of public sphere theories in reflection to the journalism, especially medical journalism, which I was also a kind of a professional worker in that area for several years before starting my PhD. Then, after starting with the PhD, I started to work at Mersin University. And after I received my PhD, I started to work there as an assistant professor. And it was in 2009 I started with Mersin University. Then in 2012, I finished the PhD.
And then you started your assistant professorship, which lasted until 2016.
Yes, in 2013, after Gezi Resistance, I started to work as an assistant professor. And then in 3 years, I find myself in this situation that will lead up to Bayreuth University.
Before we look a bit more closely at what happened to you in 2016, could you maybe set the stage a bit and take us through some of the developments that preceded the escalation in 2016? Because what we're going to be talking about later, this fateful year of 2016, it's not at all the beginning of developments. It started much, much earlier. So the situation of academic freedom and the societal discourses that have been going on, and also the situation of civil liberties in general.
Of course, everybody is talking about 2016. It's very obvious why, because it was too big what was coming. But before 2016, even in 2002, when AKP government came to power, actually it started in very little steps maybe at the beginning, but afterwards it's accelerated much. In 2002, when they came to power, they kind of applied all kinds of neoliberal rules, market rules to the universities, to academic freedom and so on. Everybody was discussing whether they were liberal or autocrats even on that time in Turkey. But when we came to 2010, it was very obvious actually that they are interfering the daily lives of people too much. After 2010, it accelerated, and when we came to 2013, everybody knows Gezi Resistance, I guess. It started in May 2013 in Turkey, a very big resistance or a very big protest movement also in Turkey's history, but it started like a very small protest movement for protecting a park, actually, Gezi Park in Taksim Square in Istanbul, a very little park, a very little green space left in Istanbul because of the urban renewal projects that AKP government was doing at that time in Turkey. And then it spread all over Turkey in a few days. Of course, it was quite obvious for us it will develop like this because it was dropping actually before Gezi. 1 year before Gezi, I can remember the internet protests in Turkey, for example, because the government was interfering also with the internet laws and trying to ban people to express their thoughts on online platforms as well. Also, the public alcohol bans Recep Tayyip Erdogan was speaking at that time that he doesn't believe in the equality of men and women, for example. He was telling the women to have at least 3 children to support Turkey's development, for example. All kinds of things, actually, all kinds of authoritarian moves are coming and accelerating until Gezi resistance. Gezi resistance was a very big no from the people, actually a very big protest movement. Almost all cities protested in Turkey except 2 cities. It was too big. For the government, I think it was a surprise as well. They didn't expect something big like that. Even now they are accusing people with making a kind of a coup attempt to the government with Gezi resistance. This is very insane. But it was a very big no. But of course, after this very big no, it accelerated more and more. Until 2016, we had lots of very big things, actually. For example, there was a peace process between the Kurdish political movement and Turkish government. And in 2015, in June elections 2015, actually, it was also a very big breaking moment for Turkey's history as well. HDP, the Kurdish party, has managed to overcome the elections in with 13%, which was a quite big success for Kurdish party, because in September 12, 1980 coup, actually, set it up election threshold 10% in order to ban the Kurdish movement to enter the parliamentary. Therefore, it was a very big move. And also, AKP government was at the first time, it is history, not be able to run the government alone. This was a very big move, actually, for the oppositional parties. It was relieving, but only lasted 15 days or something like that. After that, again, accelerated. And in July 2015, we had a very nasty event in Suruç, suicide bomber bombed himself and lots of young people who actually only gathered in Suruç in order to bring children in Kobani some toys. They were socialist young people, mostly from university students. They were there for a very good reason, very understandable reason, and they died in that village. After that, we experienced a lot of terror bombings, a lot of very bloody massacres, and then we came to 2016 with war in southeastern part of Turkey. Lots of terror bombings. Every day almost we hear something is happening, something has happened, and it was quite horrible actually. Step by step we came to 2016.
So we can see there was repression against various civil liberties, so freedom of expression, but also the freedom how to lead your life, the role of women and men, but especially then a very, very complex situation evolving in the Kurdish regions, and also repression of political expression in that, or democratic expression of political will. So we are now at 2016. I'd like to start with you personally, and later we'll maybe broaden the perspective and look at the situation in Turkey overall. But what was it that happened to you in 2016?
Maybe before I start with my personal experience, I should also add that in 2015, after this election, the government cut off the peace process, actually, and the war started again. It was a very, very dark atmosphere for all of us, with war, with terror bombings, lots of repression coming against us. Also, around the universities, it was not that easy to talk about peace, for example, at that moment. I can also remember the students from the southeastern parts of Turkey. They were very silenced. They felt the pressure. For example, when we teach, we also felt the pressure at that time, and everybody was very afraid to speak, actually, and to say something about peace. Imagine, known as Ayşe Öğretmen, teacher Ayşe in Turkish public. She was a teacher and she called television program, at that time very popular television program, and said only, please be aware that children are dying here. And after that, they accused her with making terrorist propaganda. They shut down the television program and then lots of things happened. They jailed her. It was before the peace petition we signed, for example. This was the atmosphere at that time. Nobody can speak or nobody can protest, actually. Of course, there were protests around that time as well, but everybody was afraid if they enter to the street and go to protests, there can be suicide bombings, for example. It was quite heavy, quite hard as a feeling. As an academician, I felt very repressed. I didn't know what to do. And then I found an email, and this peace petition was in my email, like many of my colleagues. It was calling to the government, stop the war and stop killing the civilians and begin with the peace process again. And we as academicians of Turkey are ready also to become part of this process, if you like us. This was the petition about. And then Recep Tayyip Erdogan accused us with terror propaganda, of course, with being betrayers of Turkey, with lots of things I cannot remember, even insults and so on. Please do feel free to interrupt
just to clarify. Mm-hmm. So the spark that really led to many, many terrible developments was an online petition calling for an end to armed attacks and calling to restart a peace process. So that is the online petition that we are talking about that was later called the Academics for Peace petition, just to clarify. So you and many of your colleagues signed this petition, and very, very quickly, once this petition gained more attention and visibility, measures were taken against you and your colleagues. Under which kind of framework did they take place? So I understand that some legal contexts were used to accuse you of terrorism links and others. How did that come about?
You mean the lawful process a bit, or?
Mm-hmm. So there were legal mm-hmm. challenges,
yeah.
Laws that already existed that were used to attack you mm-hmm. And your colleagues. So maybe we'll start with them and then look at mm-hmm. the other measures.
Yeah, of course, it was discussed also among the governments or among the judiciary processes as well. It was the law to insult the Turkishness. And also the terror laws, actually, they discussed how they can treat the peace petition as an insult to Turkishness or as a terror propaganda itself. They decided with the second one, but some of us also had judicial processes with the insult of the Turkishness as well. It started with the insult of the Turkishness, then it turned out to a terror propaganda. Even some of my colleagues have been accused of being part of the terrorist organization, not only making the propaganda. It was quite difficult also for them, I guess, put it in the laws language as well, because it was really a peace petition. Of course, in an atmosphere of war, it's always a challenge to speak about peace. We are observing it in all over the world, all over again, I guess. And it was a moment of silence in Turkey as well, because the war started again, because all the terror bombings and so on going on, lots of things going on at that moment. It was quite difficult to say something. We all felt very weak, and also we thought, what can we do as academicians? Because we felt the responsibility as well. I was at Mersin University. Lots of students are coming from the southeastern region of Turkey, and they were the targets, actually, their families. I saw the eyes of those young people, actually. They want to speak up, but they can't. And as an academician, I felt the responsibility to say something to the government as well. Actually, this petition came at that moment. Therefore, I think timely, it was quite right. And it was a call of academicians, actually, only call of academicians to the government. Of course, I also understand the agenda of Recep Tayyip Erdoğan and AKP government at that moment, because they started to interfere to the universities and academic freedom already before the petition, actually. It was coming first the students, then the workers of the universities, and then it started with the academicians, with academic freedoms. For example, 1 year before the petition, one of our colleagues at Mersin University was sued because he told that the mayor of Tarsus, the new mayor of Tarsus, is from the Islamic party, from an Islamic past as well. He was a member of MHP, the ultra-nationalist party of Turkey, and he accused our colleague to insulting him. We already started to feel the pressure, actually, before the peace petition as well.
And in the aftermath of the peace petition, what were the measures that were taken against you personally?
It started with disciplinary processes at the universities first. Of course, we were targeted from the top. Recep Tayyip Erdoğan was accusing almost every day from the televisions, from the newspapers, all the academicians who signed the petition, also the mafia bosses like Sedat Peker, who turned out to be a opposition now, actually. Even he is a target of the regime nowadays. He also threatened us, threatened the signatories of the peace petition. But first, with the disciplinary processes at the universities, it started. Then we heard that the Higher Council of Education can also open some kind of disciplinary process against us with discussing the public bans, public service bans before the decrees, actually. Therefore, we were quite repressed, of course, after all those things happened. At Mersin University, it started quite early because it was a public university, but normally public universities have contracts with the academicians, and you cannot easily break these contracts normally. But in our case, at Mersin University, the rector of Mersin University has decided, obviously, to fire all of us before the decrees, even before 2016. And he started when the contracts came. We were all applying again with our articles and so on to the university, but it's only a process, actually, normally.
Just a formality.
Not just a formality, but he started to fire us. First, they tried to ban the articles, for example. They rejected some of them and so on, but no reason. Then they were also feeling the atmosphere, I guess. They returned only just writing, they signed the peace petition, so we are firing them, we are cutting the contracts off. And it started like this. I was, I think, fifth or sixth, I cannot remember now, a colleague who was fired from Mersin University in 2016. It was October, 1st of October. Before this happened, I already decided to look around, because before the decrees even, this means I was labeled as a terrorist. I was labeled as a kind of an enemy of the state. It was very obvious that I cannot find any positions even in the private universities. Besides the universities, if I decided to work as something else, everybody will have this fear for hiring me, because this was the top of the top accusation, actually, at that moment. Therefore, I decided to look around a bit, to look outside Turkey in order to continue with the research, or with at least to live in a place and work in a place again. And after that, I came to Bayreuth.
Thank you. We'll look at what you did in Bayreuth a little later. But I'd like to come back to a few things you said. First of all, we have obviously a case here, and not the only case, of a university aligning itself with the government agenda. Be it by being ordered, or just, as you said, sensing the political atmosphere and then deciding we have to align with that political agenda. So institutional autonomy, which is a prerequisite of academic freedom, was very obviously not at all given, and there was no pushback from university leaders. You mentioned the decrees, and the decrees, I think, are something that we need to look at a bit more closely. What exactly is meant by decrees, and who ordered them, and what were their effects?
It started with 2016, the coup attempt in July, actually, called by Recep Tayyip Erdoğan God's gift after the coup attempt, because he saw the opportunity also to deal with all the oppositional forces all around, actually. Not only the universities were in target, also teachers, judges, all parts of the society. Were at the aim of these decrees. The decrees after this coup attempt, the state of emergency has been declared immediately. First, in the first days, it was not so clear what will follow. Of course, the ones who already experienced the 1980 coup was quite sure that very bad things will happen and very bad things will come afterwards. And after the emergency state has been declared, it started in 10-15 days, and the Recep Tayyip Erdoğan was actually writing all the decrees. And it was quite funny, absurdly funny, of course. In a late of night, imagine you were looking online something or reading a newspaper, and you saw your name in a decree that says you were banned from the public services for all of your life. It was so easy, actually. I was fired and wasn't any member of the university at that time. For example, the decree was in 29th of April 2017. I was already fired, not a member of the university at that time, and even I was in the decree. This is so absurd, so that you can understand what kind of circumstances we experienced at that time. Everybody was accused being a part of terrorist organization, or at least having a sympathy towards a terrorist organization. This was also a very vague term in law. How can you defend yourself even? It's very absurd, actually. And at that time, it was also banned that you cannot sue these decrees. If you listed in a decree, you cannot do anything. For a while, it was like that. Then they came up with a kind of a legal procedure. Were looking like a legal procedure, but it wasn't actually, because you cannot go to a court. Before the court, you must go to a commission, which was appointed from the government, and you must say that I'm listed in that decree, but I'm not a terrorist, and defend yourself to the commission. Of course, we did that because we wanted to take all the steps, all the lawful steps, as a kind of a resistance as well. But it lasted lots of years before we can sue these decrees. I have sued this decree as well, but still the lawful process is going on, actually. I'm still listed as a terrorist, as a part of or supporter of a terrorist organization in Turkey.
So we have a situation where we have summary dismissals of thousands, literally thousands of academics by government decree, where basically, as you said, there are lists of people. But it doesn't stop there. Those researchers, academics, are banned from entering public service, so universities, ever again. And from what I understand, private institutions also aligned with that practice because they did not want to get on the wrong side of the government, so would not usually hire academics who were banned from public service. So many, as I understand, people ended up without really being able to earn a living, even not even specifically as an academic, but anywhere else. And we have this politically appointed commission, which was installed before the judicial process. So the legal process was not open to you until you had passed this commission. Okay. So coming back to you again, you had connections to Bayreuth, or you found connections to Bayreuth. How did your way to Germany work? How did you navigate your way to Germany, and what was the support like that you received here?
At the beginning, I saw the call from Professor Hanke. She's a media scholar from Bayreuth University. She appointed that she was willing to take a Philip Schwarz fellow from the Peace Academicians from Turkey. And after the petition, actually, we became a very big network as the Peace Academics for Peace. Nowadays, even in Germany, we have a foundation in Berlin. Thanks to Philip Schwarz as well, you bring us here together, and we are still together here. This was also a kind of a chance for us to become a network, because I think at the beginning, not all of us was knowing each other as the colleagues. For example, at Mersin University, we were lucky, we knew each other before the peace petition, and we organized very quickly after this happens. But lots of universities, lots of colleagues were quite alone, actually, at that process. Some of them were threatened, and it was quite heavy situations experienced at that time. But as the signatories of this petition, we started to organize meetings inside Turkey first. We were gathering and discussing what will we do now, and how can we fight against this process. Afterwards, some of my colleagues were also friends with Professor Hanke, and this was the path for me, actually, the Bayreuth University. I decided before they started with the decrees and the state of emergency, but of course I was willing to go back to Turkey at that time. That was the original plan when I was leaving Turkey. I was hoping that in some years it will be possible to return at least. Of course, some of my colleagues have returned. Maybe we can also address this issue later. But for me, it wasn't possible to go back so easily. At Bayreuth University, I started to work as a fellow from first Felix Schwarz. Then, of course, it was also a challenge for all of us to come here and see the academic system. It was also kind of fragile, in my opinion, because with these short-term contracts and with these third-party fundings, it's also impossible, actually, to start with the research sometimes. Therefore, it was also a very big challenge for all of us to understand the academic system of Germany and to adapt to the system. And still, of course, we are trying. After Philip Schwarz, I find several scholarships at Bayreuth University, thanks to Bayreuth University and Professor Hanke again. And after that, I started to write research projects. And now I'm also Gerda Henkel Fellow and trying to continue with my research.
In addition to losing their position and being banned from public service for life, many people also experienced that their passports were revoked. So in addition of having no job and no perspective for a position, there came the limit of movement. People were not able to move, to leave Turkey. So just to add one of the other significant measures taken against academics in Turkey, so could you give us an impression maybe about the fate of other researchers, some of your colleagues who did not come to Germany or elsewhere and did not find refuge there?
Actually, this was quite heavy for all of us to experience something like that, because it was not only losing your job or your professional job, actually. it was something you worked for your all of your life, and then suddenly they can take it away. This was quite horrible for all of us, but also for the young academicians. I must admit, I was also lucky because I was already finished with my PhD. I had the networks, and I was lucky among the lucky ones. One of our colleagues, it's very heavy for all of us. It was a shock also, but took his own life at Çukurova University. He was a young scholar, finished his PhD quite recently with the peace petition. Mehmet Fatih Tıraş was his name. He took his life because he cannot find what to do after losing everything he got, actually. He was quite happy when he was with the students. I haven't met him personally before he died, but several occasions we saw each other, the discussions and so on, knew his face. But some of my colleagues were quite near to Mehmet Fatih Tıraş, and they were really devastated. It was also a very big challenge for us after Mehmet Fatih Tıraş to think about solidarity as well, because we were trying to develop networks at that time, but we couldn't help Mehmet Fatih Tıraş, for example. Therefore, the decrease was not only taking the professional life or the job or the opportunity to live in Turkey, it was aimed to take all. Actually, one journalist in Turkey said that the AKP regime government is attacking people, killing them alive, actually, because it's also insulting you, basically insulting your profession, your everything as a citizen, and everything you trust in a society can be taken away so easily. This was horrible, actually, for all the colleagues who were faced with these measures. I was among the lucky ones because I traveled before the travel ban, for example. I was already in Germany when the decree was listed. But lots of my colleagues couldn't leave Turkey. Even they had some scholarships, like Philip Schwartz, for example. They struggled for years to leave the country and come somewhere that they can again to start over. They banned everything, and they told that, I think in a television program or something like that, some member of AKP told that they can, that they is us. We can eat the roots of the trees if we like, for example. Very big insult for the honor of the human beings, I think.
So those many researchers were not able to leave, but many were, as you explained. Where did they go? You explained already that community built up in Germany, but maybe also elsewhere. Where did researchers go, and where are networks now in place?
In France, lots of colleagues and also a kind of a network from peace academicians. USA, we have also some friends. Also Italy and other European countries. Of course, not that much how in Germany, because we had also several historical ties, like you mentioned already with Philip Schwartz, actually. Lots of academicians, lots of journalists, writers choose to come to Germany because of that ties, I guess. But all over Europe now, we have several networks. In Germany, the biggest one, I guess, because we have been already founded a foundation, which is also working together with the peace academics in Turkey. Now a very big network, and we are also trying to reach the other scholars from other countries as well, who are experiencing similar things, or maybe not similar, but authoritarian or repressive regimes or wars, and afterwards they came to another countries as well. The other ones who stayed in Turkey, my colleagues, are also trying to build up new things, actually. Of course, they were banned from public services. They cannot work at the universities. Some of them managed to return with the lawful processes, but very few, actually. Therefore, everybody has built something new. For example, at Mersin Kulturhane, I must also mention you. My colleagues who were banned from public services and fired from the university built a culture house with a library in the memory of Mehmet Fatih Tıraş, this library. And they are making lots of events, discussions, everything you can imagine that normally you can also do in a, at a university campus, now happening in at Kulturhane, for example. Therefore, we are trying to build inside Turkey and outside Turkey networks that can still operate like some islands of breathing for all of us.
You mentioned earlier that some researchers who had to flee Turkey actually decided to return. And I'm wondering, what is the situation that they returned to? Were they still at risk from the accusations from before? Were they still facing legal processes, etc.? So could you talk about some of the colleagues who returned?
Yeah, of course. It's also very difficult to understand the situation, actually, because after 2016, after this coup attempt, after the state of emergency, it's getting more repressive, more authoritarian, and deeper every day, actually. Nowadays, lots of colleagues, not only the peace academics, I guess, from the universities are at risk, in my opinion. Also, for example, Boğaziçi University is resisting since almost 2 years or maybe more, I'm not sure. Nowadays, they are attacking every day to academic freedoms, every day to freedom of speech, and it's getting worse, actually. Also, the ones who returned from the European countries to Turkey, of course, in this situation, it's a kind of a decision. Nothing is wrong or nothing is right, actually. You can return or you can stay, but still at risk. Still, some of the law suits are going on. Some of us have been managed to finish the process and return to the universities, but very few, as said. It's like a kind of a hostage situation. For example, in my case, my lawsuit is waiting in Turkey since 1 year and nothing is happening with the case, actually. They are just piling away, I guess, with the other cases. Therefore, this is a kind of a situation you cannot imagine your future even 2 days after today, actually. I'm also speaking with the colleagues who returned to Istanbul or Mersin, to the cities, and they all saying that it's getting worse and worse every day, unfortunately.
And those who have not returned, or you and the community you're part of, are researchers safe outside of Turkey if they're in Germany, for example?
This is, of course, not possible. For us, it's for me, for example, I'm feeling not that important, like the journalists, for example. They are targeting journalists very hardly. The academicians nowadays, not so wanted, but journalists, for example, in Germany, Erk Acerer was attacked at his home in Berlin. Even here, they felt the pressure when they followed some news about the government. And I think it will get worse when things in Turkey get so worse. It will get worse in Germany as well. For us, of course, it's sometimes like Turkey because here a big Turkish community and also among them lots of Erdogan supporters, of course. In Bayreuth, I'm not feeling so suppressed, I can say that. But in some cities, some of my colleagues were really afraid, actually, in public, because when we was targeted like this in 2016, actually, they also used our photographs and all the informations about us in the newspapers and so on. We were real targets. So they felt here in Germany as well not safe, actually. Therefore, it's not possible to run away or to get away from this kind of threats.
You mentioned newspapers just now. And of course, you're a scholar of media and communications. So from your professional academic perspective, I'd like to ask you to comment on the role that media played in Turkey in 2016, and also the situation of the freedom of the press in Turkey now.
Of course, it's started again before 2016, but in 2016, it was horrible. Erdogan already weaponized all the media, or almost all the media. Lots of media outlets already aligned with the government, with the regime. Even that was not enough for him. In 2016, he shut down very much media outlets, even very small ones. It was quite funny, absolutely funny again, to see how intolerant he was also against the press and press freedom as well. Of course, it began before Recep Tayyip Erdogan and AKP government with the 1980 coup in Turkey. The transformation of media started actually. The neoliberalization and the coupling of Islam with neoliberalism was already in power after 1980. And I think AKP and Recep Tayyip Erdogan is the seed of those years, actually. And after he came to power, he was quite obsessed with the media, with the newspapers. And one by one, he aligned them. All the mainstream media, the news channels like CNN Turk, for example, or NTV, very big media outlets, aligned with him. And already this transformation in 1980 actually set the stage because the owners of these very big media outlets were also tycoons with lots of money. They are investing in all kinds of sectors like energy, construction, the businesses that Recep Tayyip Erdogan controls, actually. Therefore, they aligned very easily with the government, and Recep Tayyip Erdogan managed to weaponize all the media sphere to against us and against all the oppositional forces, I guess. Press freedom was already threatened when they came to power, when AKP came to power. But after 2013, I think Gezi was also a threshold for this transformation. I'm also looking very closely to those years, also professionally. And I can say that after 2013 and the resistance, Gezi resistance, it accelerated, actually. The journalists who participated to the resistance was also targeted after Gezi, and they lost their job. It starts like this in Turkey. You lost their job, you lost your job, but it's not only the job you are losing, actually. You are losing the country, networks, your daily life. And some of them are also here in Germany, like us, for example, trying to build new media outlets in Germany because they cannot go back to Turkey and cover news from Turkey.
In this context, I'd like to point out that you're also the co-editor of two forthcoming publications titled Exiled Intellectuals, Encounters, Conflicts, and Experiences in Transnational Contexts. The first volume will deal with or look at media and academics, and the second will then look at politicians and artists. We're at the end of our time almost, unfortunately. I know we've not been able to cover many, many aspects of this extremely complex and long-standing developments. Before we close, though, I'd like to ask you, from your professional perspective, but also based on your personal experiences, maybe to look at the situation in Germany, the European Union. It's a very different situation, obviously, but still, we do see attacks of academic freedom on academic freedom from various directions. We do see illiberal tendencies. We do see growing support for extremist political parties in Germany and elsewhere. How worried are you when you look at developments over the past few years in Germany and EU?
Starting with the last part, very worried actually, because we had workshop in Berlin in October and with the colleagues from Turkey, we discussed that everybody is feeling that vibe again, like in 2016, here in Germany. This is very depressing for all of us because it shows how we experienced already how fast it can develop. Actually, the rise of far right is threatening all over the Europe, not only Germany, unfortunately, but in Germany, of course, it's a very obvious threat. And it's already started to targeting all the freedoms, as far as I can also observe here. This is very worrying for me as well, because, of course, I knew that the world wasn't very beautiful because it's quite connected, actually. If we are living this in the countries like Turkey, India, Libya, I don't know, all over the countries, this cannot stop there, actually. It's effects. And I think these extreme right people are backing up and they are following what they do. For example, Orban in Hungary is very fond of Recep Tayyip Erdogan and he always praises him. What they did with media, for example, are quite similar, Orban's media and Erdogan's media. Therefore, I think we have lots of things to worry, but of course, it's a kind of a struggle. We are still struggling in Turkey. Here, we are trying to be part of the struggle in Germany also. This is why we founded the Academics for Peace in Germany as well. Not only defend the academic freedom for Turkey, for all of us, actually. Therefore, I think these steps, very small steps, are quite important. Coming to the second question, yes, the book is covering all that we talked about here as well. Not only academically, we also opened up the book to the journalists, artists, politicians who also experienced this era. This was quite interesting as well. Some of us dealt from an academic point of view, but some of us dealt from different point of views with those issues, transnational experiences in Germany. It was quite unique, I guess, because very big two volumes covering lots of different parts of the society. It will be out soon. I think in 15 days it will be published.
Unfortunately, we are indeed at, well, beyond our time, the end of our time. Before we dive into the Q&A with our live audience, I'd like to thank a number of people and institutions. First of all, of course, Universität Bayreuth for hosting us today, to the Federal Foreign Office and the German Bundestag for supporting the Humboldt Foundation and the Philipp Schwarz Initiative, to the Ministry of the Federal Ministry of Education Research for making this project possible, Fragile Freedom. But of course, most of all, I'd like to thank you, Elim, for taking a very courageous stand today and for speaking with me. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Fragile Freedom. This live podcast series is brought to you by Congressa in collaboration with the Alexander von Humboldt Foundation. Visit our website for more episodes and resources. The project is funded by the Federal Ministry of Education and Research as part of the Science Year 2024 Freedom.